Well, you're the full-time one here, so it's like it's your show. You're in control. You got this. And I
One
won't even ask
hopes.
you about the movie.
One hopes. Oh, stop with the movie. Stop. God, am I going to be doing that all week with you now?
No, I just had to get it out of
all
my
right,
system.
Fine. It's out of the way. We will not speak of it again. Hey, everybody, it's Kyle Rizdahl. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. None of us, as we like to say, as smart as all of us, except when Kimberly starts talking about that movie. And I guess we'll talk about that later.
Right. And yes. I'm Kimberly Adams. I'm in for Molly this week, the short week. It is Tuesday. That means it is time for our weekly deep dive into one single topic.
So we're going to do immigration this week. It's a newsy topic, always becoming more newsy as the administration changes. And we're going to talk about specifically family reunification as part of the immigration policy debate in this country right now.
Right. And under the Trump administration, there were hundreds of migrant parents and children who were separated at the border. And some of those families still remain apart today. And the Trump administration did so many different executive orders and rule changes about immigration that the Biden administration has been trying to unwind. But unwinding the rules is very different than actually getting the people back together.
Yeah. And some of these people have been apart, by the way. Families have been apart for years. Something like 5,500 families were separated. Parents of more than 600 children have still not been reunited with their kids, which I can't even with that, truly. And the Biden administration is now trying to and has said publicly it wants to get those families back together. But of course, it's way harder than just saying it.
Yeah. So here to make us all smart about what it's going to take to bring those families back together is Caitlin Dickerson. She's a staff writer covering immigration at The Atlantic, has been on this story pretty much since these, you know, separations started. And she's joining us now. Welcome, Caitlin.
Hi. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, my goodness. So the zero, I don't even know where to begin. It's like Kai said, it's just like, wow, people have been separated from their kids for years. So let's start from there. The zero tolerance policy that actually started this whole thing and led to the separation of thousands of families was struck down by the courts during the Trump administration. And the Trump administration was ordered to reunify parents and children even then. So why are so many still separated today?
That's a really good question, Kimberly. And right, it's an overwhelming number of people, an overwhelming task that we're talking about now. So let me just start, you know, from the very beginning. I'm going to offer a little bit of a clarification, which is that family separations began before zero tolerance was announced. So in the summer of 2018, if you remember, Jeff Sessions came out. He was attorney general at the time. He made a big speech announcing that the Trump administration was going to be implementing this zero tolerance policy, which was in a way kind of a euphemism for this idea that the administration was going to separate families. You know, what he said was that they were going to start prosecuting every single person, including an adult who was traveling with a child who crossed the border. But in effect, what that did was require the families to be separated. And that was, in fact, the point of the whole policy. But key to the reason why the families who were separated under that policy, which, as you pointed out, was struck down in a case that ordered that the families be reunified, is because family separation started a lot earlier, as early as 2017. You know, the discussions for separations began really within weeks of President Trump taking office, so that thousands of families had already been separated before the policy was announced. So then you have this court case that follows that orders reunifications, and the government still for a very long time had not admitted to the prior separations. It was in the course of this court case that the earlier separations came to light, and the lawyers who brought the case have been pushing for all the families to be reunified ever since. But the government has fought them at every single turn, and getting the information about who actually was separated has been really hard to do. And that's a big part of why, you know, we still have at least 600, but likely more than 1,000 families who are separated today.
So with the Biden administration now being going on a month old, what is the current state of play, both policy and practice? What are they actually doing?
to speak to what they're actually doing is you know, there's not really much to say at this point. The Biden administration has established a task force to look at this issue, and they've talked about a lot about what they would like to do. Of course, you know, the Biden administration is also dealing with a coronavirus pandemic and an economic downturn. And so they've emphasized that this is part of their list of priorities, but it's not one where a whole lot of movement has taken place just yet. This task force is primarily thus far dedicated toward helping with the effort to try to locate separated families and then to kind of explore what might need to happen next. And you have advocacy groups who are pushing for things like providing mental health care to parents and children who were profoundly affected by these policies. Even years later, when I talk to families who are back together now and were reunified, they're very much still suffering the consequences when it comes to their mental health. And then perhaps an even bigger ask from the advocacy community, one that has growing support, is to allow separated parents who were deported without their children or with their children to be able to re-petition the American government, because so many people ended up giving up their asylum claims while they were in custody just out of a desperation of wanting to get their kids back. Some parents were even told, you'll get your kid back if you give up your claim. Wow. And so the advocates argue that it's that pressure that the U.S. government should really have to make up for now and give those parents another shot at seeking refuge in the U.S.
You've spent the last couple of years talking to so many of these families. For the people who are still missing their kids, where are they at right now?
So parents who ended up deported without their children are scattered really across Central America for the most part. Some are probably also stuck in Mexico. It was really a matter of seeking refuge, of figuring out where people could find safety. So if people were able to get, you know, back to their homes and they weren't in danger, if they did that, then they did that. But a lot of parents, you know, they left and they tried to come to the United States with their kids because they weren't safe at home. So, for example, a couple of months ago, I spoke to a mother from Central America who had to relocate after she was deported without her daughters. And she's basically been in hiding in a women's shelter for domestic violence victims ever since she was deported, because she can't go back home because she thinks her life is in danger. And so you have people, you know, just finding places to live wherever they can. And that is, of course, part of, again, why we still have so many parents who haven't been located, because it wasn't as if, you know, people who fled their home countries because their lives were in danger, you know, just could turn right back around and go home and provide, you know, a return address to the American government. That wasn't the case at all. And so it's very hard to find people when they're living in this kind of, you know, just one day at a time and just trying to keep themselves safe and find shelter where they can kind of manner of existing.
You went down to Guatemala last summer, right? On a reporting trip?
I did.
Tell me what you found there in terms of why, for all the peril, both, you know, their own security-wise on that long, long trip, and then the peril when they get here. What did people tell you about why they're coming?
Sure. So I went to Guatemala City and a few suburbs outside of Guatemala City, and I went to try to understand the forces that had led a family I met that was living in the asylum camp outside the American border to the United States. And the reason I went there is because a young man who I'd been profiling, he died in the camp. Some people thought that he was murdered by the Gulf cartel that operates there. Other people thought that he fell in the river. No one was ever able to confirm one way or the other, but it was such a tragic ending to his story that I really wanted to try to figure out, you know, how did he end up here in the first place? So I went to his neighborhood where he grew up outside of Guatemala City, and I was really able to see kind of for the first time all these different forces that I've been hearing about for years that come together and just bear down on people such that they feel like they have no options. The first one, right, is economics. So in this community, you know, the best possible job somebody could hope for was to get a job at a t-shirt factory in town where they were making something like $10 a week and to try to support an entire family that way. You know, those jobs were hard to come by, and then that's all you have to feed your family and to pay rent. So a lot of the homes that I went to, including the home of the man I was profiling, you know, it had a concrete facade that looked like a house on the outside, like a rundown house, but a house nonetheless. But you would walk inside, and families had basically run out of money or didn't have enough money to complete the houses. So most of the houses that I saw, you would go inside and there would be no walls. It would just be, you know, concrete exterior walls, concrete floor, and then maybe some cots and maybe a, you know, broken couch with, you know, holes in it, and maybe, you know, a rickety table sitting in the middle of the room. And it's basically one big room where you have multiple generations of family living. And again, these are in homes where you have somebody who has, you know, a professional full-time job, and this is all that they can afford. And then you look outside the walls of their home and you see the violence. You know, I saw gunshot holes in various buildings, and I was right by a police station and was asking a local journalist who I was with, you know, how is it that the police are right here watching and yet so many people in this community have been killed? You know, I heard stories of random killings. And they would say basically what I learned is that in that country, you know, 9 out of 10 murders are never solved. Most violence, you know, is met with complete impunity. And that's also related to government corruption. So it's those three factors mixed together that send so many families to the United States.
Here in the U.S., what about the accountability? Is there anyone being held to account over the family separation policy in particular?
There were a lot of calls to hold people to account for family separation. I think if we want to talk about, you know, who is most associated with it, Stephen Miller is up there, President Trump's advisor, chief advisor on immigration issues. Jeff Sessions, who was attorney general when the policy was formally adopted. Kirstjen Nielsen, who served as the Homeland Security Secretary and kind of famously went before Congress and went before the American people in various press conferences and denied that the administration was separating families when they actually were. But there were a lot more people involved in family separations than those three names. You know, of course, President Trump is part of that picture. And I do think that there are increasing calls to try to figure out who else was involved, who else signed off on this practice, and should they face any sort of, you know, reckoning. And so that's an open question. I think there's a lot of pressure and attention in that direction, but it's not clear yet whether anything will come of it.
It's not just children being taken from their parents, right? There is the Remain in Mexico policy, where even now with all those snowstorms and the horrible weather, people are trapped in refugee camps on the far side of the border. That has been changed. So there are other things going on in immigration other than family reunification.
That's right. That's right. There are other ways that families end up separated through the American immigration system, and especially under President Trump. You know, his policies were so restrictive that you saw families really resorting to any option that they could in order to try to get at least some, if not all, of their family members to safety. And so, you know, on multiple trips down to the camps in Mexico, I met with parents who would break down crying with me and say, you know, I don't know what to do. I'm thinking about sending my kid off the, you know, across the river on their own. Of course, I'm scared to death that they're going to die, but I also think they're going to die if they stay here with me. You know, those camps are right under the thumb of the Gulf cartel in a very dangerous parts of Mexico that the State Department actually advises Americans against traveling to because it's so dangerous there. And so it's that sort of circumstance that has led many thousands of parents to send their children across the border on their own. And then add to that Remain in Mexico program you brought up, the coronavirus border ban, which resulted in thousands of expulsions of migrants, including migrant children. So the Trump administration first denied that it was expelling migrant children, later acknowledged that they were in fact doing it. And an expulsion is basically a very, very rapid deportation where there's no due process. There's very little even record keeping at all. And so they were basically capturing children who were crossing the border alone, putting them on planes, sending them back to their home countries, sometimes sending them back to Mexico, even though they weren't even from Mexico, and you know, leaving leaving kids stranded far away from their parents in that way too. So it's a very messy situation. And, you know, the more we talk about it, I think the more clear it becomes just how big a challenge it is to try to clean up the kind of mess that resulted from these policies.
And for the people on the other side of it, the parents looking for their kids, the kids that are able to looking for their parents, has the U.S. government given folks any kind of timeline of how long they think this is all going to take?
There is no timeline that has been made available yet. I think from the very beginning, this effort has had an ASAP timestamp on it, and many thousands of families have been found. You know, there were very extensive research efforts that went into tracking families down. People were riding on motorcycles across, you know, the countries of Central America into rural villages to try to really track people down. Those efforts were slowed down by the coronavirus pandemic because Central America, generally speaking, had pretty significant crackdowns on travel to try to prevent the spread of the virus. And so things shut down for some time. And so now things have picked back up. And I think the timeline is as soon as possible. But remember that all this time that has passed, you know, when people are living in hiding, when they may not have phones, and if they do, their phone numbers may have changed. All this just makes it incredibly hard to track people down such that, you know, the longer it takes in some ways, the less likely it becomes that people will be located.
And sorry, just to climb in here really quickly, because we can go on with this forever. This is going to take years, years and years.
It's going to take years to track down all these families. I think that's pretty safe to say. I mean, these separations started in 2017. Here we are talking in 2021, and we still have somewhere between 600 and 1,000 estimated families who are separated from each other. And then bigger than that, you know, we've talked a little bit about the implications long-term of the separations. And that, I think, is something that we're going to be talking about, you know, for the rest of these children's lives. This is really a generational, you know, years-long and decades-long conversation that we're going to keep having as journalists.
Wow. Caitlin Dickerson, staff writer covering immigration at The Atlantic. Thank you.
Thanks for taking the time.
Well, that was monumentally depressing, huh?
Well, you know, I always bring the sunshine and roses when mom makes me smile.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do. You know, it's interesting. There are so many things for which accountability is warranted in the last 4 years, and one wonders how that list is going to be prioritized, you know?
And who gets to prioritize
right,
it?
Right,
you know,
right,
is it the
right.
political agenda? Is it the humanitarian agenda? Is it the pandemic that dictates everything?
Yep.
I don't know. I can't even wrap my mind around what it must be like to, you know, have this timeline ahead of you. If you've been separated from your family for years, and then you've got years more before maybe possibly somebody's going to find them. One of the stories that Caitlin has written about this, she talks about a mother and son who were separated. And by the time she got reunited with her son, you know, he was like a teenager. He had developed and moved on to a different part of his life, and she hadn't been there for it.
Okay, we're going to take a little break rather than wallow in a story that actually should be wallowed in, but we got to go. Comments, please, if you would, on what Caitlin had to say, or frankly, what Kimberly and I had to say. You can do it by sending us a voice memo, makemesmart@marketplace.org. We will be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
All right, time for the news fix. Kai, why don't you go first?
I've got two. They're more markers than newsy stuff. I want to point out two things. Number one, on Thursday, super interesting hearing coming on Capitol Hill, the GameStop saga. CEO of Reddit's going to be there. Some of the big Redditors are going to be there. There's going to be all kinds of sound and fury about investing and is it rigged and the markets and all that jazz. So that's coming Thursday. I'm sure we'll talk about that on Marketplace. And then the other thing that I think is really interesting is the fight that is brewing that's going to be going after Joe Biden from the left on the minimum wage. Because as we know, the minimum wage is, number one, not without controversy. We did a whole thing on this on Tuesday last week or maybe 2 weeks ago. But also, the president has come out and said, you know, like 10 days, 2 weeks ago now, he said, look, I'm not sure it's going to make it into the final relief bill that I want to get passed. And now people on the left are like, hey, Joe, man, we won, and now you're bailing on us? I'm paraphrasing, but it's going to be interesting to see what happens with that $15 minimum wage. And I just keep an eye out.
Suddenly, everyone cares very deeply about the Senate parliamentarian. Because the Senate parliamentarian is the person who can sort of issue a version of a verdict, weighing in on what exactly can be covered over the under the budget reconciliation framework. And there's a lot of, you know, discord over whether or not a minimum wage adjustment should be covered under budget reconciliation. I know that y'all have talked about that on this show. And so, it's interesting because Biden has the bully pulpit, which, as we just talked about, sort of what do you prioritize and what do you push? But in some ways, because the majority in the Senate is so slim, there are some real limits on what can actually get done. Yeah. And then we get back to that question we've been dealing with throughout the pandemic of how much do you want to let wrangling over various policy items hold back the aid that the economy needs?
Yeah. And in point of fact, there's a fight for 15 strike today, in fact, on Tuesday by fast food workers. So it's newsy and it's policy, which you get everything on this podcast. There you go. Anyway, what do you got?
Well, I guess I'm going to take us deeper into the policy and wonkiness in Washington.
But it's good. It's important. I'm excited you brought this up, actually.
Yeah. So it looks like there is potentially a bipartisan move to bring back earmarks into the congressional legislative making process. Now, this was a policy that was banned some years ago in which members of Congress could attach basically anything to any kind of legislation. And it was a way to get pieces of legislation that maybe didn't have enough support to get over the line, but if you tack on, you know, an extra $10 million for someone's, you know, I don't know, like local project or like a road or a new library or something, that might sweeten the deal enough for a member of Congress to vote for it so that they could go back to their constituents and say, hey, look what I got out of this for our community. And so it was a process that definitely greased the wheels of legislative policymaking, but was kind of ripe for abuse. And one of the people that President Trump pardoned was actually one of the members of Congress that is responsible for earmarks getting banned in the first place. But that's a side story. So in this moment of sort of partisan gridlock and these very slim Democratic majorities, there is an effort to bring back earmarks, and this has everyone kind of relitigating whether or not these are a good or bad idea. You may have also heard this known as pork barrel spending.
My favorite euphemism for this is congressionally directed spending, like individual congresspeople saying, I want this money for a bridge to nowhere, congressionally directed spending. I think it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out.
Yeah, because, you know, It's also sort of an option for the minority to play a little bit more palatable role in policymaking. So maybe there's a piece of legislation they hate and it's going to be passed with or without them. But if they can get something out of it, it can at least look bipartisan. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how this one plays out.
Yeah. All right. That's it from us. Let's go to you.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
We're going to discuss all the things. Beth in Nebraska. Statement. Yes. Beth in Nebraska talking about women in the workforce. Here you go.
You guys are talking about this more and more, and it has me thinking and feeling a lot of things. Frankly, I'm pissed. I'm angry. Women have lost the gains we have worked so hard for in the last few decades. And when this pandemic is over, I don't want shrugs and excuses instead of jobs and paychecks. So I'm going to propose something, and I think for it to work, we need to start the messaging right now. We need to put some heavy societal pressure on companies to seek out women, especially women of color, and employ them. I know. This sounds incredibly facile, perhaps a little naive, and definitely feels been there, done that. But I think without this pressure, companies will continue to do whatever the hell their culture dictates, and I'm not sure that includes hiring these displaced women workers. And the one thing that seems to be more effective in the recent past, thanks to the super boost from social media, is making specific messaging campaigns and maybe sprinkle in a little guilt and threats of boycott in for good measure. Not only that, but it's a simple message. Hire women back. That's it. Simplicity sells, and I'm going to scream it until they do it.
Yes. Next.
Amen, sister.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I've done a couple stories on this at this point about how hard it is for people who leave the labor force in recessions to get hired back, whether they be women, people of color, older workers as well. The other thing that's bumping up against this is unless we resolve our childcare situation in this country, that's going to make it even harder to hire the women back. And also the who is the we we're talking about? Who's going to pressure these companies? Mm-hmm. Is it going to be the federal government? Is it going to be consumers? Automation is going to play a role as more and more of these roles are automated. So it'll be – that's a great, nice, and simple message, and I hope it works. But I'm a little skeptical.
Yeah, well, look,
I know it's not half full, half empty day yet.
Yeah. it's an enormously complicated problem with a lot of layers. But I think the general sentiment is right. That pressure has to be mounted, and then as that pressure campaign gets traction, then you start parsing out the individual layers of it, because it's childcare, it's homeschool Zooming, which hopefully will be gone soon, it's black and brown women, it's all of those things.
But like she said, start early, get it going.
Yeah.
All right. On to our next voice memo. Thank you for the voice memo coming from Sasha in Oakland.
I was listening to your proposed YouTube special about Kai reacts to stonk memes, and I just had to share something I saw today. As I came out of my office for lunch, I spotted a digital billboard ad across the street with the words, New Zealand funds KiwiSaver scheme go brrr, with some rocket emojis.
Wow.
KiwiSaver is the New Zealand pension scheme, kind of like 401ks. This ticked so many boxes for me. Stonk memes, hello fellow kids, internet language in real life, and an actual clever attempt at improving financial literacy and promoting saving for retirement among younger people. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did.
Perfect.
Thanks for making us all smart.
Perfect. Love that one. That's great, Sasha. Thanks for sharing that one. That's cool. Oh, my goodness. So we do have a photo of the billboard, actually. Tony's going to put it on the show page. Of course, Tony, our digital analog and cyber producer. Andy in Chicago, a cool space thing happening this week. Here you go.
I just wanted to skew from politics for a second to talk about the Mars Perseverance rover. This rover is going to land on Mars this coming Thursday, and the landing diagram that they have for this rover is bonkers. It's going to be lowered down on some sky cranes, and once the rover touches ground, the sky crane is going to fly away and explode somewhere while this rover carries on the underside of its belly a helicopter that will be able to fly around on Mars and scope out the surface and area. And I think this just sounds so bonkers and amazing. And it's just nice new news for a change. I hope you guys are doing well. Happy Chinese New Year.
Space is cool. Thanks, Annie. That's a good one. I like that one.
It is. It is. Just like fingers crossed and all good, you know, feelings going to the rover to land safely, because it's a dicey operation.
Yeah, it's really hard.
I will be watching.
Yeah, of course.
All right. And now we are going to leave you with the Make Me Smart question, which is, what is something that you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about?
Something I thought I knew that I later found out I was wrong about was how hard it would be to record 1 to 2 minutes of decent audio to send to you as a voice memo. I have been going at this for about 35 minutes now. I don't even know how many takes I've had. I've had takes and retakes of even just this, of what I've learned. So I really thought it would just be straightforward, turn on the recorder, crank through my message, and send it to you. But every time I ended up sounding too stupid or fumbling over words, so I had to reset it. Anyway, thanks for all your shows. Appreciate it. And keep on keeping on.
Okay, so look, here's the deal. And this is my rule about being on the radio or on a podcast or in any audio form of entertainment or content delivery. If you think about how you're sounding on the radio when you're on the radio, you're going to screw up how you sound on the radio. So don't think, just talk. And if you screw something up, how many times have you heard me screw something up on this podcast? Just send it.
Yeah, like forgetting to say that was David in Nebraska.
we're gonna fix that in post. Well, we were going to fix it in post. We don't have to now. Right? See? There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. I screwed it up and everything's fine. And everything is fine. There you go, David.
Yeah. Learning how to talk to people about how to use voice memos to record themselves in their stories, the stories that we do every day, has been quite the learning curve for me over the last few years as well. So, David, I feel your pain.
It's all good.
I feel your pain.
It's all good. Tony, by the way, is going to re-up the instructions on how to send voice memos. It's going to be on our show page as well. Because we want to hear from you. That's it. That's what
we
want to
hear
do.
Your voice. Yeah. We want to hear your dulcet tones.
Tomorrow is, what do you want to know, Wednesday. Our email is makemesmart@marketplace.org. And obviously, as I think we've been hammering home pretty hard on this episode of this podcast, voice memos are better. That's all I'm saying. Don't think, just talk.
Yes. All right.
Wow.
What's the ending music? Also sounds great. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Marissa Cabrera. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. And Erica Phillips writes our newsletter and the smart speaker skill.
Ben Talladay engineered today. Charlton Thorpe is going to mix it later on. Ben and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Donna Tam is the senior producer. The executive director of On Demand is Tar Nieves. And there we go. I'm done.
Yes.
Tuesday in the can.
Yeah. It's going to be a fun week, Kai.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.